Is there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Words to Write By listeners.
Hello.
How you doing today? I guess they can't really reply, can they?
No.
That's all right. Anyway, today is a big, big day.
As you probably know from our last podcast, we are starting a new book. And the new book is called Writing the Memoir by Judith Barrington.
Yes. So for our memoir writing listeners, this will be a nice treat for you. And for our fiction writers, know that fiction and memoir kind of similar, so don't tune out.
And just as when we were doing Scene and Structure by Bickham, Renee learned a whole bunch of tricks for her memoir, I'm hoping that by practicing a little memoir writing, I might write my own fiction better.
Yeah, hopefully. Cool. And Carrie, my workshop leader, you heard her in a couple of podcasts ago. I've upped my writing game, and I would definitely say that Scene and Structure, I mean, all the books have helped, but Scene and Structure really helped. Like, she was really impressed with how I've improved since I've read that book. So you can give a listen back to those episodes when you got the time. And for now, we're going to move on to our new book by Judith Barrington.
So before we get started, who is this person that we are trusting the next 6 months of our writing lives to, or our writing game practice to?
A poet.
A poet.
A poet. So I'm like super excited because she is a poet. She's written one memoir. She's written a book on memoir. And then she's written like 9 poetry books. I think that's awesome, personally. She says in her introduction of this book, Writing the Memoir, she says, my own route to memoir was via poetry. And I wrote, yay.
And I think I wrote, sounds like Renee.
I am very happy that we picked this person. I did some research on her. You can go to her website, and she has her bio. And I figured I would just read a few snippets to give you a background on who this lovely writer is. Judith Barrington was born in England, and she made her home in Portland, Oregon. And since then, she spends time in Europe doing reading and workshops. Oh, sorry. I said 9 poetry. She's the author of 5 poetry collections, 2 chapbooks, a prize-winning memoir, and a text on literary memoir. She's won the Lambda Award for memoir, and she was a finalist in the Penn Martha Albrand Award for the Art of the Memoir.
And what's her memoir about?
Ah, I'm glad you asked. Ooh, look, we've published in the same literary magazine. I feel like a celebrity. So she wrote a memoir called Life Saving. Here's a description of her book on Goodreads. In 1963, when poet Barrington was 19, an event sliced her life in 2. The cruise ship, Laconia, departed Southampton, England, with her parents aboard. 3 days later, north of Madeira, a fire broke out, and 131 passengers, including her parents, were left stranded without lifeboats and drowned.
Wow.
So it starts with a shocking event. Barrington recalls the 3 years that followed this incident, in which she fled to a small town in southern Spain. Her book doubles as the lesbian coming out story of a young woman who must resolve her fractured relationship with her parents, flashbacks to a lonely childhood in which she couldn't connect with either parents, politically despised her pig-headed father, give way to a future in which Barrington is finally able to achieve a degree of resolution about her loss. Sounds like I need to read this book because it sounds very much like what I wrote. Anyway, there you go. She also talks a bit about Spain under Franco in less detail and solid philosophical insight into the tragedy that changed her life. So it's got a little of everything. It's got a coming of age story. It's got a grief story. It's got a redemption story. And it's got a little bit of history about Spain. So it actually kind of mixes quite a bit of different memoir genres and tropes.
Which is good. If you're going to write a book about how to write the memoir and you've written one memoir, it should cover a whole bunch.
Right. I will say that I tried to look up her poetry online. She's an older poet, so maybe that has something to do with it. But she was not in Poets.org, Academy of American Poets, nor was she in the Poetry Foundation. And I find that extremely upsetting. So if a poet is somehow connected with those websites, they need to get their act together and put this woman on that freaking website. She's got lots of poetry. She's won lots of awards. Why is she not on that website? I don't know. Anyway, shame on you, Academy of American Poets and Poetry Foundation.
You have opinions today, Renee.
I do, damn it. Well, that's part of what's going to happen, right, later, is we're going to talk about judgment, which I think is very interesting. But we'll get to it. Anyway, Kim, would you like to say anything before we get started?
So we're going to briefly go over the introduction, and then we're going to jump to the first chapter. The introduction starts off with an event in 1920 when there was the first meeting of the Memoir Club with Virginia Woolf. And there's a little history and all that, and I think I'm just going to go to the quotes. I like this one. As soon as I started to write about my own life, I understood that to speak honestly about family and community is to step way out of line, to risk accusations of betrayal, and to shoulder the burden of being the one who blows the whistle on the myths that families and communities create to protect themselves from painful truths.
Damn. She's got some really, really good quotes in here. I wrote so many down. She talks about the feminist movement, active in the early feminist movement and shaped by the consciousness raising that insisted on scrupulously examined lives. I was challenged in my 20s to take a second look and then a third and a fourth one at the facts of my life. Yeah. So I think we picked a good book. I think we're in capable hands here. She does talk a bit about Virginia Woolf in a group called the Bloomsbury Group, because Virginia Woolf does write some semi-autobiographical. They didn't really have memoir back then. And that's the thing here. So memoir is very, very popular right now. But if you go back in time to like the 50s, you would not normally get much at all.
Or even like the 80s. I mean, I didn't remember running into memoir when I was a kid.
She has a wonderful introduction. I would actually suggest people get this book and read it. But if you don't want to do that, you just want to listen to us, she gives us a really good quote here that kind of introduces us to both memoir and the book itself. She said, "This book is the kind of book I once looked for but was never able to find. It opens up the conversations about memoir I wish I'd had when I was starting out and addresses the nuts and bolts questions that pertain to the memoir genre, as well as some others that apply more generally to prose writing." Bam. Thank you, Judith Barrington. I need this book.
And also another thing is that whenever we start a new book, we try to pick a book that's different than what we had before. And there's definitely, I think, a little more a structure to this book than our previous book, including the fact that there are exercises at the end of each chapter.
Yes, very good exercises, I might add. So far, I am a fan, but you know what happens, dear listener, as we continue through these books, it sometimes suffers from the diminishing returns of the writing craft book. I'm not sure if this one will, but we're going to find out. So far, I'm very excited.
First chapter, definitely very good. The first chapter is called What is Memoir?
Yes. She goes into the history a little bit. She talks about how the term memoir is used to describe something closer to autobiography than essay-like literary memoir. She doesn't mention stop time, but that's a big one. This a guy named Frank Conroy wrote a book in the 1970s. That's not the first memoir, technically. Like, St. Augustine, I guess, could have had the first memoir. But that one is the one that pushed memoir into the mainstream. And then, you know, you got the Wolf Brothers and then Mary Carr in the 90s. And then now it's like everyone's freaking writing a memoir.
Everyone's writing a memoir, which is why we decided to do it for the podcast.
Yep, yep.
Okay, so she talks about memoir versus autobiography, and I didn't really have a good idea of what the difference between those two were. I thought they were more interchangeable until I got to know you and learned more about what memoirs were. Here she talks about the difference between an autobiography and a memoir, and I'm sure you've addressed this question quite a bit.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. An autobiography is like a person's whole life. Like, mm-hmm. You're old, and I was born in blah, 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 and then, you know, you go to, you know, near your death. Or, I guess a biography would be after you're dead.
Right. Right, someone else writes it.
But there's probably more in common with a biography and an autobiography than there is with a memoir, because a memoir is a slice.
Yes.
Slice of life, very theme-driven. It's not a whole life. I mean, it could be 2 weeks. It could be one experience. The one that comes to mind is Orange is the New Black. I mean, yes, it's a Netflix series, but it was started as a memoir. It's just a memoir about this woman, Piper, who ends up getting in trouble years after she did a federal crime and smuggled drugs through whatever. And then she ends up going to prison for it. And then she's there for just a year. She just writes about that.
They got that many seasons out of 1 year?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Then after that, it was very embellished. But it was based on characters that she'd met. And she wrote about other people in her memoir. She just, you know, stayed in contact with them and continued to tell the story. Although, yes, it was fictional at that point. After the first season.
So that's what an autobiography is. And then she talks about some things that memoir is similar to. And she talks about how it has certain characteristics with an essay. Specifically, she says, rather than simply tell a story from her life, the memoirist both tells the story and muses upon it, trying to unravel what it means in the light of her current knowledge. So that's like an essay. It's not only that you just like say what happened, but you also think about why this happened, what were the consequences. It's more contemplative than just simply an autobiography, which would be like stating, you know, I did this, I did this, I did this.
Right. It's kind of like the journey within the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Of how you're coming up with conclusions and stuff.
And then the other thing that she says it's a bit like is like fiction writing. She says, moving both backwards and forwards in time, recreating believable dialogue, switching back and forth between a scene and a summary, scene and sequel, and controlling the pace and tension of the story. The memoirs keeps her readers engaged by being an adept storyteller.
Yep. It's like a hybrid, she says.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you got to do all those things. You got to know how to get into a scene. You know how to get out of a scene. You have to put sequels in there, like from scene and structure. You have to have good dialogue. You're balancing a lot of fictional elements in order to tell a good story. That's the thing, too. You can't just write the story as it happened because it's not going to be interesting. You know, one thing she talks about is it being believable. That's one of the big difference between fiction and memoir is that we're pulling from our lives and you're limited to what you can talk about in your life. Whereas in fiction, you're limited to how believable
you can make everything.
Right. But I would say that rule also applies to memoir because even if something happened, if it seems unbelievable to a reader, they're just going to tune out.
Right. But on the other hand, we like it going up to the edge. We like the memoir that's like just beyond what's believable or just at the very edge. Can you believe this actually happened to this person?
Yeah, exactly. But if it goes too far, then your readers are just like, whatever. And some people are like, well, that's how it happened. It's like, okay, I'm sorry. I use that horrible voice. Like, <"Durr." laughs> you know, well, that's how it happened. It's like, well, that's nice, but that's not how I want to read it. That's not like how it's going to work in the book. So,
well, can you give an example of like someone saying, well, that's how it happened, and you saying that, no, they have to change?
I had a student once. She was writing about a big moment in her life, and she was 18. And her big moment in life was that her and her boyfriend decided to elope in Vegas, and they didn't tell their parents, and they just rushed up there. And I thought that was cute. You know, it's fun and reading about it. And they got in a lot of trouble. And what's really funny is, okay, so now you're married, but now you're in trouble? But I guess they had to get a divorce after that. I'm not sure. But it was a wild time for her. It's all she wrote about. She fictionalized it. She memoirized it. You know, it was like the only thing she wanted to write about during the whole semester. And she wasn't giving us reasons why she wanted to do it. She just talked about how excited she was. She talked about how nervous she was and how much trouble, quote unquote, trouble she was going to get in with her parents. And I was like, well, this isn't very believable. You're not even giving you reasons why you want to marry this guy. She goes, well, this is how it happened. And I said, okay, yeah, I get that you got married in Vegas. And it was like, hotter than a pepper sprout situation. But why? I mean, like, I believe that it happened. I don't believe why you did it. Like, I don't get it.
You know, it seems to me that maybe the reason why she got in so much trouble and all the things came out afterwards is she didn't have a good reason for doing it and didn't have a good idea in her mind why she wanted to do it.
Right. And so, although in her life that was a big deal, I was like, meh. I mean, it is a big deal, but not really.
Lots of people get married in Vegas.
Yeah, lots of people get married in Vegas. Lots of people, they don't think it through. You know, I myself, my first marriage. But just because it was big and interesting to her doesn't mean it was big and interesting to the rest of us. I don't know if that answers your question because you were talking about, is it believable? But to me, believable and interesting are similar.
We inherently think that things that happen to us are more interesting than stuff that happens to other people. And with the memoir, you need to show people that it's interesting.
Yeah, you need to care about us. Or you care about the protagonist.
Mm-hmm. The truth in memoir is one of those really tricky things. I've been in critique groups where it's just a general critique group and people bring stuff to the table and there's not like anybody that's been trained in teaching memoir or writing memoir. There's a certain amount of stumbling about as people attempt to write their memoir. They read some famous memoirs, they know stuff that happened in their lives, and they go out and try to do it. And one thing that comes up is the whole business of truth in memoir, which goes to what your students were saying. Well, this is what happened. How does truth work in memoir?
Oh, boy. I feel like I'm getting interviewed here. I mean, well, this is a joint thing here, dear listener. Like, you are also an expert as much as I could be.
Yes, but the truth in journalism is a lot different.
So, okay, I'll talk about this, but then you're going to have to talk about truth in journalism. So, truth in memoir, as I understand it, it has to have happened to you. You have to have real life things, but you have to understand that when someone's writing about a conversation and it's in quotes, that conversation has been crafted because nobody remembers conversations exactly as they happened.
Right.
Maybe it was 10 years ago and you know this story happened. You know your mother said that thing. But what was the conversation leading up to it? And you know one was there. But what about the thoughts you had? It used to trip me up when I first started writing my memoir. You know, people would be like, well, what was kid Renee thinking? And I'm like, I don't know. And I had to figure it out. And now if I went back in time and I said, hey, little girl Renee, were you thinking that when this happened? I don't know what she would say necessarily. I don't know. You know, but it's like you have to dig deep. And sometimes some people composite characters, just like as Jocelyn was saying, sometimes you just remove a brother from a book. But you can't lie or you turn into that one famous dude who wrote a million little pieces, got berated on Oprah.
Yeah. The actual big events have to happen. But once those events happen, you can move them around in time. You can cut people out if they weren't really part of it. You could hide the details about that person. You could change details about their life so they stay hidden. You can do a whole bunch of moving around so long as what happened actually happened. The other thing I liked is that quote of making up a better ending to your story while presenting it as true, or worse still, inventing a whole piece of your life because it makes for a good memoir, will often backfire.
Yeah, people can smell a rat.
Or rather, you're putting yourself out there, you're telling people this is true, these things happened, and especially the outrageous ones, you know, there are other people that these things have happened to, and they're going to come forward and say, no, she's lying.
Yeah, and they'll look into the truth. They might find it, too.
From a journalistic standpoint, these things have to happen. If you quote somebody, if you don't have it written down as the exact quote, you need to summarize it in some way, or you need to show it to them and make sure they're okay with it, that is quote is used. So,
well, okay, so you're a journalist, so I want to know. Like, there's that term, everyone hates that term now, but fake news. people say, oh, I don't like reading from Fox News versus NPR. People pick where they get their news because it's got slants in it, right? Like there's a slant or an interpretation of the events that had happened. So that sounds almost like memoir, where you're giving your own slant to truth.
Well, here are a couple things. You can always find somebody to say something about something. You can always find a quote source. And as a journalist, if you're going to quote somebody, they should be somebody valid to quote for this. They shouldn't be someone that has a history of lying. Or if they have some reason in which they would be on a particular side, it's important to say, and, you know, this person who was a lawyer for this other person said such and such. Journalists often lie, I don't lie, but through omission. Often pieces get slanted through omission. They just don't include one particular feature. They don't include a voice from somebody that would reflect upon the story in a different way. Or they really hype a particular person. As a journalist, these things haven't happened to me. I'm finding other people and I'm reporting on what they said. So, you know, people lie. You can report truthfully on what people lie about. I mean, already you can report on someone who's lying, and whether or not you know that they were lying also determines that. But largely, a journalist is outside the process. And a memoirist is inside the process.
Ooh, I like that. We're going to put that on our social media. Quote by Kim Smugov.
So we've talked about like how memoirs are not like autobiographies. We've talked to how they're similar to essays and fiction. We've talked about truth in memoir. What else is in this chapter?
Okay, just one quote about what Barrington says about truth. She says, when you name what you write memoir or fiction, you enter into a contract with the reader. You say, quote, this really happened, unquote. Or you say, quote, this is imaginary, unquote. And if you are going to honor that contract, your raw material as memoirist can only be what you have actually experienced. Mm-hmm. So just know that if you want to write memoir, you're going into a contract with the reader. And if you break it, readers are fickle beasts, just like geeks. And man, once you say Han did not shoot first, then they will just go after you with pitchforks.
And evidence.
And evidence. And old versions that end up getting scrubbed by Lucas. Anyway, I'm not bitter.
So she's got in this also a couple little aside, little grayed out boxes, which I'm sure that the teacher and Renee says, oh, a little text box here, must cover. There's one on voice.
Yes, and she puts in a quote here by Barbara Drake that says, voice is the medium and instrument of poetry, whether that poetry is spoken aloud or read silently. Voice is also the mark of the individual poet, right? So she's borrowing that for memoir. Barrington says the memoirist needs to have a fingerprint, even if she only speaks as herself. And that memoir, like column writing, requires that the reader feels spoken to and that the voice is conversational. So when you're writing memoir, don't get all heady. You know, don't get all hoity-toity. People read memoirs like they drink water, right? Like they just inhale memoirs because they're usually easier to read.
Right. I liked her comment that it's almost like, you know, someone is sitting in a chair and you're sitting next to them and they're like, I'm going to tell you a story. And just lean in to find out what their story is going to be about.
Yeah. It's kind of like that. I mean, you still have to like write well, but it has more of a conversational tone.
I'm going to say like when I was reading some Joan Didion, it felt like some fairly more advanced writing language.
I love Joan Didion.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say that that's like easy reading necessarily.
You know, but we weren't reading her memoirs. We were reading like her essays.
That's true.
She's writing essays and those can be different. Those follow different rules. And this book does not necessarily cover the essay. Although I would encourage you, Kim, maybe to start writing essay when we start writing memoirs, unless you just want to write memoir because you have that journalism background.
One last characteristic of the memoir that is important to recognize is one which also applies to essays, in which George Lukacs described as the process of judging.
What does she mean by that? Or what does George Lukacs mean?
It's not judgy. you know, I'm better than you, or look at what stuff you're up to. But it's not the nasty tendency to oversimplify and dismiss other people out of hand, but rather the willingness to form and express complex opinions, both positive and negative. Is there something special to memoir that you would do this? Obviously, in essays, people make judgments.
Yeah. So I would say, like, in fiction, usually there is a character and they're thinking, but we have a bit of a distance between the character in a fictionalized story and ourselves as the reader. And the events kind of speak for themselves. We allow the events to speak for themselves. We allow a character that we are a little bit different from speak about those events as it happened to them. But in memoir, something happened and you are the central character and you have to judge, you have to decide and make clear, was it a good thing? Was it a bad thing? What did it do to you? Is this person to blame? Are you to blame? That's what I'm getting out of it. But I'm not sure if that's exactly what she means, because she focuses a lot on what it's not. You know, but she doesn't really talk about how it reveals itself in a memoir, does she?
Here's a possible way to look at it. When I'm writing fiction, I might have one character say about another character, that person's a bad person, or that person really messed me up. And I might show in kind of a more removed way the destruction that a person has on other people's lives. But part of my pleasure in reading and writing is I let the audience make up their own mind.
Right.
And it's different if I'm writing in a first person, especially if it's first person where the first person is obviously addressing someone. I expect them to process a little bit what's going on and make decisions. And I think maybe from a memoir perspective, it's like, okay, all this stuff happened to you. So what? Like, how have you changed as a person owing to all this stuff? How have you grown? How have these elements impacted other decisions that you've made later on in your life? I don't want to just see everything you do and make my own judgments on it. You are telling me your story. I'm paying also just to hear what you think about it.
Yeah. She says you have to take a position about the meaning of your story. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, maybe is what she means by judgment. It sounds similar to what you're saying. You can't just tell the story, well, this happened, and then walk away from it. You have to, like, well, what do you think about it?
Here's a quote. Without this attempt to make a judgment, the voice lacks interest. The stories, becalmed in the doldrums of neutrality, become neither fiction nor memoir, and the reader loses respect for the writer who claims the privilege of being the hero in her own story without meeting her responsibilities to pursue meaning. Self-revelation without analysis or understanding becomes merely an embarrassment to both the reader and the writer.
Bam! Ooh, embarrassment. Well, there you go, dear listener. Be careful there.
I've seen this in the first drafts of people's memoirs in these critique groups, where it's just a collection of things that happen. And at a certain point, I kind of lose interest because, well, you know, it's going to be one other bad thing that happens to you here. It's going to be one more element of that. Like, what makes this particular confrontation with your mother at this point any better than this one that happens like 10 pages later? Like, what is the point?
Right. What is the point? And that elusive point, if you've been listening to this podcast, you know I've mentioned that many times. What is the damn point? And that is something that is constantly chasing after. I'm getting closer. I'm getting better at it. But I don't know if memoirist even knows what the point is until they've got like four drafts or more.
Yeah. And it's tricky because often an individual story is delightful and interesting in and of itself. But reading an entire book about someone, then you start to need a point, because I find your individual pieces absolutely delightful. But what I've noticed is, like, yeah, when you put it all together in a chapter, or you have like two more chapters in, like, why did you tell this story to your grandfather here? There's a tendency to just say, you know, here's all these wacky people in my family. Well, that's good, but how does it all fit together?
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I'm glad she addressed this, because hopefully she can explain it to me in her book, and she will. Maybe this is her contract with us, her promise, her promise to us in these writing craft books, right? They have a little promise. Maybe this is a little promise to me personally that she will explain this and help me so that I can get it.
And from that point, we could jump right to the thing at the end of each chapter called Suggestions for Writing.
Yes.
This one you have 8 different, not necessarily writing prompts, but 8 different like ideas or suggestions. We're going to take the first 2 because they kind of go into each other.
Yeah, they all kind of riff off each other. Like, for example, in the third one, it says, you know, you look at your work from the second prompt. It's like for you to do number 3, it would require you to do number 2. And even the last one says pick number 6 or 7 and talk to your friend about it. It's like, okay, well, that would require you to get all the way to 6 and 7, which probably means you have to do number 1 and then 2 and then 3 to get that far.
Which makes me suspect that if other chapters are like this, we will probably be doing a lot of number 1 and number 2 prompts.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, number 1. Think of a family story you have been told or have heard told many times. Make notes about it and decide what the theme of the story is. Then write down the story succinctly. Do not stray from the theme and do not explain to the people who the people in the story are. Do not give background information, which is actually nice. So one of the problems I always have with writing prompts is like, I want to get to this like scene, but like this person's got these at least 3 paragraphs of backstory to kind of work to that point. So this is nice. It's like, we don't worry about backstory. We don't worry about.
So if I talk about like Uncle Stan or something, right? Do I just not say Uncle Stan?
Well, you can say Uncle Stan.
But I don't have to give background.
But you don't have to say my mother's brother.
Okay.
Who came to visit us from Nevada that one day back when I was 11 years old and, you know, thought that smoking was cool. So that's the first part of it. And then the second part is imagine you're talking to a close and trusted friend. Well, we don't need to imagine because we'll workshop this together. Write down your thoughts about the story from number 1 above as if talking over with that friend, assuming that she has already heard the story. Do you think it is true as told? What was left out so that everybody could feel comfortable with it being a family story? What does it say about the people involved and what does it say about you? So I think the idea here is we're not really writing memoir at this point. We're taking a well-known family story and then we're going to look at what's underneath it, what isn't said. So the first part is to write down a succinct story and then we'll send it to each other. And then we'll write something more for the discussion about what we think is true, what was left out, all these other questions. So we'll have an actual one piece of writing, and then we'll have a whole bunch of notes to discuss.
We'll just ask it on the podcast. What do you think, do you think it is true as told? We'll read it and ask the questions, and then they could just answer right on the air.
Yep, sounds good.
And now, on to our activity.
Okay, so we're going to have Renee do hers first, and then we'll save mine for the bonus podcast. We could start off by reading the activity, or do you want to tell us a bit about it first?
I'm kind of itching to talk about it a little bit first before I read this.
Okay, let's do that.
So I had to write it 4 times because the prompt was deceptive, and I kept reading the prompt and realizing I was breaking the prompt every time.
So what was it that you were breaking the prompt? Because it's just, think about a family story you have told or have heard told many times.
Oh, Sarah broke it again. I did break it. I didn't actually follow the prompt. This story is not really told. This is just a memory I have. It's a very poignant story that I remember a lot, but it was never told. God damn it. So I tried doing this. Well, read the next sentence in the prompt because this is important. This is where I kept getting hung up.
Okay. Because I want to stop before that and say that one of the reasons why we do these exercises, because you read them on paper, it's like, oh, that makes perfect sense. And you never do it and you never realize that maybe it doesn't make as much sense as you thought. Anyway, so the next one is make notes about it and decide what the theme of the story is.
Okay. Next sentence.
Then write a story down succinctly. Do not stray from the theme and do not explain who the people in the story are.
That part. Do not explain who the people in the story are.
Okay, so what I took that to mean was that you weren't supposed to meander about like who this was and whose cousin and all those details, but you were just like you had to get a little bit of information about who people are.
Well, she said not to do it.
Well, I mean, yeah, but we could say, you know, and my husband, Maciek, da-da-da.
Oh, see, I thought that was forbidden.
Okay.
And so I have a different version of a different story that was told a whole bunch of times, And I kept breaking the rules like that.
Okay. So do you want to read the one that you end up doing, or do you want to read that one that maybe broke the rules that might fit a bit better with what you're looking for?
Well, the other one, it was unfinished.
You want to read what you have?
Maybe.
I will say the one that you had that you gave me to read was a little bit trickier because it's not a story as much, because there's like three parts to it and it doesn't quite. If the other one feels more like a story to be told, I think you should do that one. How about you read it? And if we decide it's not going to work, we'll go to the other one. Pretend we never talked about that.
Okay. When my grandmother was in her late 80s and I in my late 20s, she asked me to go with her to Indiana to visit her sister Gladys. See, I broke the rules, right?
No, because I think you need to have that context.
Okay. Grandma said this may well be the last time she saw her because she didn't know if she could make the trip again. So in late summer, I flew to Indiana with my grandma to see her sister and brother-in-law, both of whom I'd never met. I didn't know anyone in the family, really. I had met my grandmother's brother. See, I'm meandering.
Yeah.
I'm going to skip ahead. After we arrived at their house, I was served fried chicken. I told them I don't eat meat or pork, so I was served fried chicken for 10 days. I was there and became acquainted with various shotguns leaning in every bathroom, kitchen, dining room, living room, doorway, like cowboys on smoke breaks. In Uncle Ralph's car, he had a handgun and a leather glove nestled in the ashtray in front of the gear shift. See, I'm meandering. It's so bizarre how I just can't stop myself. Over the next few days, they poured bacon grease over my lettuce, and I kept going on and on. Once inside, I quickly learned both Gladys and Grandma had the hoarder gene, and then I talk about them being hoarders. And it's like, well, where is this story going? Right? And then here it is. Grandma loved telling the story of her missing eye and how she lost it. My grandma had two strong characteristics which colored her character. I can't get to the damn story.
Okay, let's back up. Tell me how she lost her eye.
Right.
Tell me it.
Okay. The story goes, this is a meta story. She had one eye that was like really cloudy.
Okay.
And she couldn't see through it. It was kind of bulbous. It was her right eye, and she called it her bad eye. And the story goes that her brother was throwing a stick in the air, pretending it was an airplane, and it hit her in the eye. And that's how she got her bad eye. So she always told us, you be careful when playing, kids. And then just toss us outside and lock the door.
So she literally had the, you're going to poke your eye out if you keep playing like that.
Right. She had her story. She had lots of stories. This was one of them. Until we went to Indiana. And I'm an adult now. And she's an old lady. And her sister's an old lady. And we're sitting around. Like, I don't know, maybe the second day. Grandma gets up and leaves, and it was like they had been waiting the whole time to be alone with me. And they go, did she tell you how she lost her eye? I said, yeah. They go, well, that's not really what happened. And I'm like, what? What's going on? And they go, oh, no, it was her brother, all right. But they were fighting. And he stabbed that in her eye. And I'm like, what? No way. Brutal. And then they told me all sorts of stories about Grandma shot snakes out of trees when she was a kid. And I mean, just crazy stuff. And I was like, well, who is this person? And then I was like, wow, that's dark shit.
So that's the story.
Okay, the story is, it's meta.
No, the story is, growing up, my grandmother always used to tell us not to play with sticks because when she was a child, her brother was playing with a stick, pretending it was an airplane, and it hit her eye. It destroyed her eye. It was gray. It was cloudy. She couldn't see about it. And it was always this cautionary tale. Except then I went to visit her family. And while we were there, we were at the table, and my grandmother went away, and they leaned in and said, did they tell you about how she lost her eye? And I said, well, he was playing with a stick. And, you know, no, they weren't playing. They were fighting. And suddenly I was thinking about my grandmother, like actually in a tussle with somebody with a stick. And he meant to hit her in the eye like that. I'm thinking, whoa, my family is dark.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's your story. Okay. So, that's my story. So what's the point here? Like, why did she make us do this? That's another thing.
Because I think the idea is that you, unfortunately, aren't really highly trained in writing memoir. Like, when you're describing that, there are all these asides, all these elements, all this stuff that was building
up. Am I not
up.
Supposed to do all that? Am I doing it wrong?
No, but majority of people don't approach memoir only having heard stories of their family. Only having these, like, you know, these, like, sit-down for two-minute stories with a punchline and all that other stuff.
I wonder if there's something wrong with me.
Well, there's something wrong with everyone.
All right, no, but I mean, like, okay, this is not the first time I have messed up these prompts.
Uh-huh.
But I also have issues with, like, narrative and, like, plot. I wonder if this just highlighted that.
I think it might.
So what am I missing, then, when I'm telling a story? How did you tell that story?
Because I knew what the punchline was going to be, and I built everything up to the punchline.
So the punchline is that I had been lied to.
Yeah.
How did you build up to the punchline?
Well, you know, like, I started with the framing. Like, you know, as growing up as kids, we were always told this by our grandmother. The reason she told us was because this thing happened to her. And that's what I always thought until I went to go visit her family. And then, da-da-da-da-da, punchline, I came to the revelation that this woman had been lying to me about this stuff and that she was really much worse than she let on.
Right. This is interesting. I'm hearing it. I know there's something there I'm not getting, and I know it's there. I can't see it, and I can't hear it, but I'm listening to you. Is this making any sense? This is very odd. This is a very odd sensation I'm having.
So when I was doing my journalism program, one of the things we did was news writing. And we started off with this exercise where basically, let's imagine something happening to a professor in class and this and this and this and this. And let's say you're driving past and you see your friends and you got 1 minute to tell them what it was. And you need to make sure that your lead of the story has as much critical information. Like, you know, when it happened, where it happened. So there was that kind of gunshot technique of giving information that journalism teaches you to do.
Is that what you did in the beginning?
A little bit of that, but I think the whole idea of, like, basically cutting off everything that's extraneous and just going for the story that's there.
Interesting. I wonder if I would benefit from reading a journalism craft book.
you might, but I think the idea, too, is that this was a starting off point. This whole thing that she gives it is a starting off point for how do you take a story that's been in your family and how do you actually elevate it to the point of being a memoir?
Okay. Did my story sound like it was a memoir?
Yeah, as you were reading it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounded okay.
It sounded great.
And it sounded like a story?
It sounded like,
see, I'm really good at describing stuff, but that doesn't necessarily mean I actually get to the damn story.
Well, it was meandering a little bit, but it did feel like it was like setting up for, like, we're setting the place and the location and the people and this whole thing you were experiencing visiting these people and all these little details so that when you get to that point of the story, we already have a sense of where we are and what's going on.
That's really interesting. That's so weird. It's just, it plagues me, this problem with plot. And like seeing things in a story, like my brain just doesn't want to stitch it together in the right way. It's not like I don't understand the story arc. It's just bizarre, you know?
Yeah.
Dear listener, it's bizarre. And I do it and I'll do it accidentally. Or I'll do it and I don't see that I did anything, but it works. That's how, it's like I stumble upon it and I'm okay. But just getting it, like being able to repeat it on command is not something that I can do. You know what I mean? Jelly
yeah.
Bean?
It's not easy stuff. And I think, well, first of all, a lot of your family stories are a bit darker. But you have used them to entertain other people, right?
Right. And I did it in poetry. And in poetry, it usually has an arc. It doesn't always. I have poems that are narrative arcs, but I don't think they're the same thing, actually. So this is a very short prose poem.
Okay.
My father's wife. Now that I'm done putting her shoes on the proper feet, it's time to get her shirt on. Her left arm gets stuck, her eyes close, she whimpers. It's okay, I say, guiding her wrist to the sleeve. I gave up on directive cues days ago. It's not like up means down. Down is just the right shoe on the left foot. Up is all dressed in time for CNN. Minerva is living proof that if you drink yourself to dementia and then want something done, I will have to do it for you for the rest of your life. On my way to the kitchen to do her laundry, the TV tells us a hurricane is blowing Texas into Ohio. I'm so glad I live in California. Why don't people evacuate when they have the chance?
I love you, Minerva says. Still not a story, but it captures a lot of elements.
It's not a story. That's a story.
I mean, if it was a story, then after you got her dressed, then something would happen. What you did was you segued into an observation that is actually, you're thinking one thing, but you're actually observing what you're doing too.
Yeah.
People being in a situation where they shouldn't and just not getting themselves out of it.
Right. But then in the end, she's like, well, I love you. And it's like, I'm not being appreciated, but then apparently I was, even though she probably didn't even know what she was saying.
I think what would make that a story is then for you to sit back and say, oh, I guess maybe she does appreciate me. Or maybe this is the reason why people stay in these things, for a bit of hope that they're actually making a difference.
You think that's what makes that a poem and not a story?
I think it's beautiful, and I think it really captures something. But I'm not quite sure if you were sitting around telling somebody, you'd tell them the story that way. Like, you'd tell her the beginning part about how, you know, she had the stroke and this is how, you know, she got herself to this position and all that. But you wouldn't have, like, said, and then I saw the TV that was talking about this and it made me think. Or you would say, and then I saw the TV and it was talking about this and it made me think about my own situation.
Yeah.
Because in a poem, you don't necessarily tell people what to think.
Right. But isn't that the difference between showing and telling? A showing is showing the story. You don't tell people, except that here we're telling a story. It's like, I'm impossible for me to tell a damn story. I can't tell. I'm not a teller.
Well, let's go and just...
Okay, let's go to the questions. Yeah. Let's go to the questions.
Do you think it is true as told?
Yeah. Oh, this is for you. Oh. Here, I'm going to ask you these questions.
All right.
So, dear listener, just to make this clear, this prompt is 2 pages and it has 8 parts to it. We did part one. Now this is part two. Imagine you're talking to a close and trusted friend. Write down your thoughts about the story. We are going to talk the thoughts out instead of writing them down. So one of the questions is, do you think that this story is true as told?
You know, the thing is that there's 2 different parts. There's what your grandmother told you, and then there's what her family told you. And I don't know if either of them are reliable or truthful, but I do believe that it's true in that you experienced it.
Okay, so there's 3 stories going on.
Yeah.
There's my story of the experiencing it, mm-hmm. of the listening to the stories, and then there's one person telling a story and then another family.
And I think that's actually something about, you should just consider about memoirs, that you've been told all these stories, but you don't necessarily know if they're true.
That's true. And some of them are made up in your head. Like, believe it or not, you think your brain has it all figured out. But let me tell you, after writing this memoir of mine for so long, I have unearthed things within my own mind, and it has not always been pretty.
But I think also that's part of memoirs. Often it's layered. It's like, this is the thing that the people told me. This is the thing I discovered later. This is what I then decided was true. Like, there's a memoir has those layers. And we right. enjoy those layers, and discovering something we think is one way is something else.
True. What was left out so that everyone could feel comfortable with it being a family story? I'm not sure I understand that question, but...
It's all those stuff you cut out that you don't actually want to embarrass somebody too fully. Like, you're telling a story, and maybe this particular family member was a bit meaner than all that, but you kind of gently massage it a little bit. Or you don't reveal that one really dark aspect of this family member, you just let it go.
Oh, I highlight that shit.
Yeah, I think you do.
Wait, what? That's what that question is implying? What was left out so that everyone could feel comfortable? See, in my head, I think the word everyone means the reader. Make the reader feel comfortable. It's like, why would the reader care?
Right.
But everyone in the story, so you don't hurt their feelings. What? I don't know if this book is for me, dear listener. We'll find out. All right, so... What was left out? Could you tell there was anything left out?
Well, when you're reading the original version, it seemed like it had everything in there.
Yeah.
But the summarized version, I left out who you were talking to. I had your grandmother and her brother, and the people at the table were just her family. There's mm-hmm. no details about who these people were other than, you know, that they had a southern accent. I didn't say where they were from.
Kentucky.
The thing is that it didn't matter. What was all important here wasn't about these family members at all. It was that you were being told a true story about your grandma that she'd never wanted you to hear.
Right.
And they were specifically knew she wouldn't tell you the real one, and they wanted to tell you.
Right. Which, that adds layers. So here's a little fact. her brother, the one who did that to her, I think, he lived about 3 hours away in California. And they were actually on good terms. I met him once. I didn't know my family. I didn't know any of these people, and neither did my brother. We never really met them. I mean, like, we met them when we were little, like, once. She isolated everybody. She was, like, control master.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to control the story and the narrative of everything. She was a control freak and a hoarder, which usually go hand in hand.
Oh, what was your theme of that story, by the way?
Lies.
Lies.
Lies. All right. There's a third question here. What does it say about the people involved? And what does it say about you? Dun, dun, dun. Okay, this is going to be fun.
Well, it obviously says that your family was full of kind of semi-truths and kind of a certain amount of vindictiveness. Honestly, if that had happened to my sister, I would not grab her granddaughter and basically, like, tell her about that awful thing. I mean, that would not be an appropriate thing for a more balanced family to reveal to someone who's visiting for the first time. I mean, why bring up that kind of dark secret or that kind of dark family history bit?
I don't know. I guess I'm used to dark history, so... My theory, all it is theories, my theory is that she's always kind of like this. Like, she's a different person with her family,
mm-hmm.
and there's certain things about her that they don't like.
Yeah, obviously sounds like kind of as a mean-spirited family.
Yeah.
As far as you, I think it just shows that this is the family you grew up in.
You were just reacting to everything here, so there really wasn't anything about you.
The story was not about me. Was it supposed to be?
No. I'm just saying.
I mean, I did write one about me, and you read it, but we didn't read that one.
Right. What was the question again? The second part of the question was, what does it say about you? Or
yeah, what does it say about the people involved? So you think that they're just kind of vindictive, mean people?
Unfortunately, yeah.
Did you think Grandma was mean and vindictive?
Not necessarily. I would not hold her responsible for not telling the truth that, you know, she actually got into a fight. I mean, if you watch kids play, it's a fine line between that point of stick for just playing and fighting. So it would be a good lesson to teach kids anyway to get them not to play with sticks and poke each other.
Okay. All right. And then what does it say about you?
About you.
Me. How does it say about me?
It's okay. Be honest.
So it doesn't really say anything about you as a person in the story itself, but it does say about question, well, why you picked this one. And you pick it because it's like, can you believe what my family was like?
It feels very odd that your family would have told you that story when your grandmother was around. It's removed enough in distance. The woman's dead. The family members are dead. For you to relate that story now, it doesn't feel like there's anything mean-spirited about it. It's more like, can you imagine?
Okay. But I mean, the voice and everything, like the voice you choose or the way you write your story says something about you as the writer.
When you were reading the excerpts that you had, there was definitely a lot of your reaction to this family that you were being exposed to for the first time and kind of your horror to the whole thing. For a California girl to go and basically visit these rather hick relatives that, you know, only could serve her fried chicken because she didn't eat pork.
Right.
There's definitely a kind of a fish out of water aspect to the whole thing. And you're just relating all those different details.
Right. So I'm going to read one little, it's not even a paragraph, it's like three sentences. This is not in there because I wasn't allowed to put it in, but I crossed it out.
Okay.
But I think this will illustrate how one tells the story makes them a character. You are a character, even if you're not doing anything in the story.
Okay.
So I wrote, after a couple of days, I came to suspect they were introducing, quote, the South to the grandchild from, quote, California. Over the next few days, they poured bacon grease over lettuce before I could serve myself a salad. Ralph shot and killed a groundhog and left it on the porch by the front door for me to find when I woke up. I was poured a tiny glass of white lining, i.e. moonshine, which lived in a locked desk drawer. Like, that would reveal something about me as the protagonist.
That you're more naive and that you weren't.
Well, that I knew what was up and I'm just kind of like, eh.
Ah.
You know, there's other ones about, like, I quickly learned both Gladys and Grandma had the hoarder gene. I could tell Gladys had a thing for Tupperware. Plastic in various shades of ancient were stacked in piles, taking up every spot on her kitchen counter. Ralph took me aside once while the ladies toured their gigantic motorhome and asked, Jane does it too, doesn't she? The collecting? Yeah, she's a hoarder. It's pretty bad. He shook his head, closing his eyes briefly as if Gladys's mountain of Tupperware flashing before his eyes. So, right, so clearly
I think it's funny, right? You think it's funny. Mm-hmm. So I'm adding humor to these like layers. But what does that say about me? Those sentences, does that reveal anything about me as a protagonist?
It seems to me that you and what was in
Ralph
are having a moment when you're both kind of commiserating about this particular quality these people in your lives have.
Right. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is I don't think I'm a nice narrator.
That part actually sounded kind of nice.
What?
That you both are commiserating kindly about these women that have this habit of like collecting stuff. And there's kind of a like, yep, it's rough. You know, that's how they are. Yep, that's the case.
Okay. Maybe I'm hard on myself. I feel like I'm kind of a jerk when I write, and I'm okay with that. But I guess maybe I'm not as bad as I thought.
Yeah, I don't know. And my issue here with that revealing is that I write fiction. And when I write fiction, I reveal a hell of a lot of stuff in little asides. They're very deliberate things. And it's because I'm writing fiction that I can do that sort of thing. Like I set up a memory or a scene or something specifically to show this character is good in a crisis situation, or this character is, you know, is secretly thinking these other things about people, but it's very positive on the face. But that's a scene that's written and set. And here you're trying to take an established scene and have it show aspect. I mean, it's not as easy to slot it in.
Yeah. So do you think if I turn this in as Judas Barrington, she's teaching a class, right? Let's imagine she's teaching a class. She does do workshops, by the way. You can go on her website. Would she, like, what comments would I get back?
She would say, this is beautiful writing, Renee. This is so detailed and so fantastic. And I don't think you need this class. I think you should be in the advanced level, not the beginner level here.
No.
Because you are writing at a much, I think that this exercise is to basically start people that want to write a story about themselves and have never done it before. So you're stepping back, you're saying, okay, you want to write your memoir, let's start by a story that you've heard a bunch or you've told a bunch, and then we're going to build it up.
So it's interesting, though, because maybe I should go to the advanced class, because there's something about this that I am having a very hard time doing.
I suppose. I mean, I don't know. That might be a bit much for this exercise, but it seems to me that the set of prompts is basically designed to take a short family story and to elevate it to something like what you're writing there.
Okay, I wish she would have said that. I wish the point of the assignment was written in a little paragraph in the beginning before we get to the prompts.
She would have said, okay, so since you've never probably written a memoir, let's start with something really simple. I just want you to think about a family story. Imagine that you're telling it to somebody else in a situation and you don't want all the details. How would you write it down?
That's what I want! That's what I want! I wanted that!
Okay, so if you happen to get this book and you read this book and you want to do the prompt, that's what the first prompt is.
Yes, that is the first prompter, listener/writer.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm very curious. You can go to our website and email us and let us know what you think about this prompt. Am I going crazy or what?
You can check out our bonus podcast and see how I did this. And I think I was follow the prompt a little bit more. But
Kim always follows the prompt. She's so good at that.
You know, I used to work in a lab. I had to make sure I was reading the instructions. You know, you do baking. You said treat it like a baking list where you have to get the things right. Anyway.
Okay, well, I will say this. I made a new pumpkin pie this year. I tested it out like a couple weeks ago or a week and a half ago to make sure I was going to make it, because I almost always make the Libby's one. That's the one my mom told me to make. Well, I went off tradition and I'm like, I'm going to make this other one that I found in a cookbook. Would you believe it? I forgot to put sugar in it.
How did it taste?
Luckily, I figured it out. For some reason, I put it in the oven.
You didn't taste the batter at all?
No. I put it in the oven.
Isn't that one of the fun parts about baking, though? You get to taste the dough and the filling?
You don't eat raw flour. You don't eat a custard. That's what a pumpkin pie is, a custard. It's got 4 raw eggs in it.
You just crack the eggs. They're fine.
Right, but it's not going to taste like pumpkin. Anyway, I should have, yes.
But it's going to taste sweet and tasty.
Well, so what I did, I put it in the oven. And like a minute later, my brain was like, something's missing. And I don't know why I'm thinking this. And I went to the recipe and I went, shit. And I pulled it out of the oven and I poured the sugar in and mixed it up in the pie crust and put it back in. Okay. Phew.
Anyway.
No, it does happen, dear listener. I don't always read the instructions.
Anyways, we are going to call this the end of our first episode on our new book. And if you want to find out how my exercise went, you can check out our bonus podcast on our Patreon site. And if you subscribe for like $3 a month, you get access to more attempts of us doing writing prompt exercises and learning from our mistakes. So you don't have to. So anyway, we'd love if you subscribed, or if you are enjoying this podcast, to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. That really helps. And we will see you in a couple weeks' time.
Couple weeks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Hello, all these people. I was about to say something. I forgot what it was. Welcome to the new book.